track. Hey, Simon. How was the weekend? Didn't get any gardening done. Bloody rain. Anything interesting this morning? He poured himself a cup of coffee. Simon's English breakfast tea wasn't bad for tea, but tea just didn't make it for Jack, at least not in the morning. They didn't have bear claws here either, and Jack had neglected to get his croissant on the way in. Not yet, but something's coming in from America. What is it? Basil didn't say, but when something comes in by hand on a Monday morning, it's usually interesting. Must be Soviet-related. He's told me to stand by for it. Well, might as well start the week with something interesting. Ryan sipped his coffee. It wasn't quite up to what Kathy made, but better than tea. When's it coming in? About 10. Your station chief, Silvestri, is driving it over. Ryan had only met him once. He'd seemed competent enough, but you expected that of a COS. Even one in a sunset posting. Nothing new from Moscow? Just some new rumors about Brezhnev's health. Seems that stopping smoking did him precious little good, Harding said, lighting his pipe. Nasty old bugger, the Brit analyst added. What about the stuff from Afghanistan? Ivan's getting cleverer. Those Mi-24 helicopters seem to be rather effective. Bad news for the Afghans. How do you think that's going to play out? Harding shrugged. It's a question of how many casualties Ivan is willing to take. They have the firepower they need to win, so it's a matter of political will. Unfortunately for the Mujahideen, the leadership in Moscow doesn't trouble itself very much with casualties. Unless something changes the equation, Ryan thought out loud. Like what? Like an effective surface-to-air missile to neutralize their helos? We have the Stinger. Never used it myself, but the write-up's pretty good. But can a mob of illiterate savages use a missile properly? Harding asked dubiously. A modern rifle, certainly. Machine gun, sure. But a missile? The idea is to make a new weapon soldier-proof, Simon. You know, simple enough that you don't have to think while you're dodging bullets. There's not much time to think then, and you make the steps as short as you can. Like I said, I've never used that one, but I've played with anti-tank weapons, and they're pretty simple. Well, your government will have to decide to give them the SAMs, and they haven't yet. Hard for me to get overly excited about it. Yes, they are killing Russians, and I reckon that's good. But they are bloody savages. And they killed a lot of Brits once, Ryan reminded himself, and Brit memories are as long as anyone else's. There was also the issue of having Stingers fall into Russian hands, which would not make the United States Air Force terribly happy. But that was well above his pay grade. There were some rumbles in Congress about it, though. Jack settled into a seat, sipped his coffee, and read his message traffic. After that, he'd get back to his real job of analyzing the Soviet economy. That would be like drafting a road map of a plateful of spaghetti. Silvestri's job in London was not a secret. He'd been in the spook business too long, and while he hadn't been burned per se, the East Bloc had pretty much guessed which government agency he worked for by the end of his stay in Warsaw, where he had run a very tight shop and winkled out a lot of good political intelligence. This was to be his final tour of duty. The same was true of most of his officers, and since he was respected by various Allied services, he'd drawn the London posting, where his main job was interfacing with the British Secret Intelligence Service. So he had an embassy Daimler drive him over across the river. He didn't even need a pass to get through security. Sir Basil himself was waiting for him at the entrance, where hands were cordially shaken before the trip upstairs. "What's the news, Randy?" Well, I have a package for you, and one for that Ryan guy, Silvestri announced.
Indeed. Should I call him in?
The London COS had read the cover sheet and knew what was in the packages. Sure, Baz, no problem. Harding, too, if you want. Charleston lifted his phone and made the summons. The two analysts arrived in less than 2 minutes. They had all met at least once. Ryan, in fact, was the least familiar with the other American. Sir Basil pointed them to seats. He'd already ripped his envelope open. Silvestri handed Ryan his own message. For his part, Jack was already thinking, oh, shit. Something unusual was in the offing, and he'd learned not to trust new and different things at CIA.
This is interesting, Charleston observed.
Do I open this now? Ryan asked. Silvestri nodded, so he took out his Swiss Army knife and sliced through the heavy manila paper. His message was only 3 pages, personally signed by Admiral Greer. A rabbit, he saw. He knew the terminology. Somebody wanted a ticket out of Moscow. And CIA was providing it with the help of SIS because Station Budapest was currently out of business.
Tell Arthur that we will be pleased to assist Randy. We will, I assume, get a chance to speak with him before you fly him off to London.
It's only fair, Baz, Silvestri confirmed. How hard to pull this one off, you suppose?
Out of Budapest, Charleston thought for a moment. Not all that difficult, I should think. The Hungarians have a rather nasty secret police organization, but the country as a whole is not devoutly Marxist. Oh, this rabbit says that KGB may have compromised your communications. That is what Langley is excited about.
Damn straight, Basil. If that's a hole, we have to plug it up fast.
This guy's in their Mercury? Jesus Christ, Ryan breathed.
You got that one right, Sonny, Silvestri agreed. But what the hell am I going into the field for? Jack demanded next. I'm not a field officer. We need one of ours to keep an eye on things.
I quite understand, Randy, Charleston observed, his head still down in his briefing papers.
And you want someone whom the opposition doesn't know?
So it seems.
But why me? Ryan persisted.
Jack, Sir Basil soothed, your only job will be to watch what happens. It's just pro forma.
But what about my cover?
We'll give you a new diplomatic passport, C answered.
You will be quite safe.
The Vienna Convention, you know.
But it'll be fake.
They won't know that, dear boy.
What about my accent?
It was painfully obvious that his accent was an American's, not a Brit's.
In Hungary? Silvestri asked with a smile.
Jack, with their bloody language, I seriously doubt they will notice the difference. And in any case, with your new documents, your person is quite inviolable.
Relax, kid. It's better than your little girl's teddy bear. Trust me on that one, okay? Silvestri assured him.
And you'll have a security officer with you at all times, Charleston added.
Ryan had to sit back and take a breath. He couldn't allow himself to appear to be a wuss, not in front of these guys and not before Admiral Greer.
Okay. Excuse me. It's just that I've never been in the field before. It's all kind of new to me.
He hoped that was adequate backpedaling.
What exactly will I be doing, and how do I go about it?
We'll fly you into Budapest out of Heathrow. Our chaps will pick you up at the airport and take you to the embassy. You will sit it out there. A couple of days, I expect, and then watch how Andy gets your rabbit out of Redland.
Randy, how long would you expect
to get this moving?
End of the week, maybe a day or two longer, Silvestri thought. The rabbit will fly or take the train to Budapest, and your man will figure how to get him the hell out of Dodge City. 2 or 3 days for that, Sir Basil estimated. Mustn't be too quick. Okay, that keeps me away from home for 4 days. What's my cover story?
For your wife, Charleston asked.
Tell her that you have to go to... Oh, to Bonn, shall we say, on NATO business. Be vague on the time factor, he advised. He was inwardly amused to have to explain this to the innocent American abroad.
Okay, Ryan conceded the point.
Not like I have a hell of a lot of choice in the matter, is there? Upon getting back to the embassy, Foley walked to Mike Barnes's office. Barnes was the cultural attaché, the official expert on artsy-fartsy stuff. That was a major assignment in Moscow. The USSR had a fairly rich cultural life. The fact that the best part of it dated back to the Tsars didn't seem to matter to the current regime. Probably, Foley thought, because all great Russians wanted to appear kulturni and superior to Westerners, especially Americans whose culture was far newer and far crasser than the country of Borodin and Rimsky-Korsakov. Barnes was a graduate of the Juilliard School and Cornell, and especially appreciated Russian music.
Hey, Mike, Foley said in greeting.
How's keeping the newsies happy? Barnes asked.
The usual. Hey, I got a question for you.
Shoot.
Mary Pat and I are thinking about traveling some, maybe to Eastern Europe, Prague and like that. Any good music to be heard that way?
The Prague Symphony hasn't opened up yet, but Josef Rocha is in Berlin right now, and then he's going to Budapest.
Who's he?
I don't know the name, Foley said, as his heart nearly leapt out of his chest.
Hungarian native, cousin of Miklos Rocha, Hollywood composer. Ben-Hur and like that.
Musical family, I guess.
He's supposed to be excellent.
The Hungarian State Railroad has 4 orchestras, believe it or not, and Josef is going to conduct number 1.
You can go there by train or fly, depends on how much time you have.
Interesting, Foley thought aloud. Fascinating, he thought inside.
You know, the Moscow State Orchestra opens up beginning of next month. They have a new conductor, a guy named Anatoly Shemyov. Haven't heard him yet, but he's supposed to be pretty good. I can get you tickets easy.
Ivan likes to show off to us foreigners, and they really are world class.
Thanks, Mike. I'll think about it.
Later, man.
Foley took his leave. And he smiled all the way back to his office.
Bloody hell, Sir Basil observed, reading over the newest cable from Moscow.
What bloody genius came up with this idea? He asked the air.
Oh, he saw. The American officer, Edward Foley.
How the hell will he make this come about? The Director General wondered.
He'd been about to leave for lunch at Westminster Palace across the river, and he couldn't break that one off. Well, it would be something to ruminate over with his roast beef and Yorkshire pudding.
Lucky me, Ryan observed back in his office.
Jack, it would be less dangerous than crossing the street, which could be a lively exercise in London.
I can take care of myself, Simon, Ryan reminded his workmate. But if I screw up, somebody else takes the fall.
You'll not be responsible for any of that. You'll just be there to observe.
I don't know Andy Hudson myself, but he has an excellent professional reputation.
Great, Ryan commented. Lunchtime, Simon, and I feel like a beer.
Duke of Clarence, all right.
Isn't that the guy who drowned in a barrel of Malmsey wine?
Worse ways to go, Sir John, Harding observed.
What is Malmsey, anyway?
Strong and sweet. Rather like a Madeira. it now comes from those islands, in fact.
One more piece of trivia learned, Ryan thought, going to get his coat. In Moscow, Zaitsev checked his personnel file. He'd accrued 12 days of vacation time. He and his family hadn't gotten a time slot at Sochi the previous summer. The KGB quota had been filled in July and August, and so they had gone without. It was easier to schedule a vacation with a preschool child, as in any other country. You got to run away from town whenever you wished. Svetlana was in state-provided daycare, but missing a few days of blocks and crayons was a lot easier to arrange than a week or two of state primary school, which was frowned upon. Upstairs, Colonel Rozhdestvensky was going over the latest message from Colonel Bubovoy in Sofia, just brought in by courier. So the Bulgarian premier had agreed to Moscow's request with a decent lack of annoying questions. The Bulgars knew their place. The chief of state of a supposedly sovereign nation knew how to take his orders from a field-grade officer of Russia's Committee for State Security, which was just as it should be, the colonel thought. And now Colonel Strokov of the Derzhavna Sugarnost would be out picking his shooter, undoubtedly a Turk, and Operation 666 could go forward. He would report this to Chairman Andropov later in the day. Three bodies, Alan Kingshot asked in considerable surprise. He was Sir Basil's most senior field officer, a very experienced operator who'd worked the streets of every major European city, first as a legal officer and later as a headquarters troubleshooter, in his 37 years of service to Queen and country. Some sort of switch, is it? Yes. The chap who suggested it is a fan of mincemeats, I imagine, Basil responded. Operation Mincemeat was a World War II legend. It had been designed to give Germany the impression that the next major Allied operation would not be the planned Operation Husky, the invasion of Sicily, and so it had been decided to suggest to German intelligence that Corsica was the intended invasion target. To do this, the Germans were given the body of a dead alcoholic who'd been transformed after a death of dissipation into a major of the Royal Marines, putatively a planning officer for the fictitious operation to seize Corsica. The body had been dropped in the water off the Spanish coast by the submarine HMS Seraph, from which it had washed to shore, been duly picked up, delivered to the local police, autopsied, and the document case, handcuffed to the cadaver's wrist, handed over to the local Abwehr officer. He'd fired the papers off to Berlin, where they'd had the intended effect, moving several German divisions to an island with no more military significance than the fact that it was Napoleon's birthplace. The story was called The Man Who Never Was, the subject of a book and a movie, and further proof of the wretched performance of German intelligence, which couldn't tell the difference between the body of a dead drunk and that of a professional soldier.
What else do we know? I mean, Kingshot pointed out, what age and gender, sir?
Yes, and hair color and so forth. The manner of death will also be important. We do not know those things yet. So the initial question is a broad one. Is it possible to do this?
In the abstract, yes. But before we can go forward with it, I shall need a lot of specifics. As I said, height, weight, hair and eye color, gender, to be sure. With that, we can go forward.
Well, Alan, get thinking about it. Get me a specific list of what you need by tomorrow noon.
What city will this be in?
Budapest, probably.
Well, that's something, the field spook thought aloud.
Damned grisly business, Sir Basil muttered after his man left. Andy Hudson was sitting in his office, relaxing after his plowman's lunch in the embassy's pub, along with a pint of John Courage beer.
Not a tall man, he had 82 parachute jumps under his belt, and had the bad knees to prove it. He'd been invalided out of active service 8 years before, but because he liked a little excitement in his life, he'd opted to join the Secret Intelligence Service, and worked his way rapidly up the ladder, mainly on the strength of his superior language skills. Here in Budapest, he needed those. The Hungarian language is known as Indo-Altaic to philologists. Its nearest European neighbor is Finnish, and after that, Mongolian. It has no relationship at all with any European language, except for some Christian names, which were conveyed when the Magyar people succumbed to Christianity, after killing off enough missionaries to become bored with doing so. Along the way, they'd also lost whatever warrior ethos they'd once had. The Hungarians were about the most unwarlike people on the continent. But they were pretty good at intrigue, and like any society, they had a criminal element. But theirs had mainly gone into the Communist Party and power apparat. The secret police here, the Ayavidelmi Hatoshag, could be as nasty as the Cheka had been under Iron Felix himself. But nasty wasn't quite the same as efficient. It was as though they tried to make up for their inbred inefficiency by viciousness against those whom they blundered into catching. And their police were notoriously stupid. There was a Hungarian aphorism, as stupid as six pairs of policemen's boots, which Hudson had largely found to be true. They weren't the Metropolitan Police, but Budapest wasn't London either. In fact, he found life pleasant here. Budapest was a surprisingly pretty city, very French in its architecture, and surprisingly casual for a communist capital. The food was remarkably good, even in the government-run worker canteens that dotted every street corner, where the fare was not elegant, but tasty. Public transportation was adequate to his purposes, which were mainly political intelligence. He had a source, called Parade, inside the Foreign Ministry, who fed him very useful information about the Warsaw Pact and East Bloc politics in general, in return for cash, and not very much cash at that, so low were his expectations. Like the rest of Central Europe, Budapest was an hour ahead of London. The embassy messenger knocked on Hudson's door, then reached in to toss an envelope onto his desk. Hudson set down his small cigar and lifted it. From London, he saw. Sir Basil himself. Bloody hell, Hudson thought. His life was about to get a little bit more interesting. More details to follow, it ended. About right. You never knew it all until you had to do it. Sir Basil wasn't a bad chap to work for, but like most spymasters, he greatly enjoyed being clever, which was something never fully appreciated out in the field, where the worker bees had wasps to worry about. Hudson had a staff of three, including himself. Budapest wasn't a major station, and for him it was a way station until something more important opened up. As it was, he was young to be a station chief. Basil was giving him the chance to stretch his legs. That suited Hudson. Most station chiefs sat in their offices like spiders in their webs, which looked dramatic but could actually be quite boring, since it involved writing endless reports. He ran field tasks himself. That ran the risk of his being burned, as Jim Zell had been. Bloody awful luck. Nothing more than that, Hudson had learned from a source named Boot, who was right inside the AVH. But in the danger came the charm of the job. It was less dangerous than jumping out the back of a Lockheed Hercules with 60 pounds of weapons and rations strapped to your back. Also less dangerous than patrolling Belfast with provos about. But it was the skills learned in the city streets of Ulster that gave him his street smarts as a spook. As with everything else in life, you took the bitter with the sweet. But better, he told himself, to take his bitter by the pint. He had a rabbit coming out.
That ought not to be difficult, though this rabbit had to be an important one, so much so that CIA was asking for assistance from six, and that didn't happen every day. Only when the bloody Yanks buggered things up, which was, Hudson thought, not too infrequent. There was nothing for him to do as yet. He could not know what needed to be done until he had a lot more specifics. But in the abstract, he knew how to get people out of Hungary. It wasn't all that hard. The Hungarians were insufficiently wedded to Marxism to be that serious an adversary. So he sent off a message-received dispatch to Sanctuary House and awaited further developments. The British Airways' noon flight to Moscow was a Boeing 737 twin-engine jet. The flight took about 4 hours, depending on winds, which were fairly calm today. On arriving at Sheremetyevo Airport, the diplomatic courier walked out the forward door and breezed through immigration control on the strength of his canvas bag and diplomatic passport, then walked to the waiting embassy car for the drive into town. The courier had been there and done that many times, enough so that his driver and the embassy guards knew him by sight, and he knew his own way around the embassy. With his delivery made, he headed down to the canteen for a hot dog and a beer, and settled into his newest paperback book. It occurred to him that he needed to exercise some, since his job was entirely occupied with sitting down, in cars and mainly in airplanes. It couldn't be healthy, he thought. Mike Russell looked over the monstrous one-time pad he'd been sent, hoping that he wouldn't have to use it all in one day. The sheer drudgery of transposing random letters was enough to drive a man mad, and there had to be an easier way. That was what his KH-7 encrypting machines were for. But Foley had suggested to him that the -7 was not fully secure, which thought outraged the professional in him. The KH-7 was the most sophisticated encryption machine ever made, easy to use and utterly impossible, so he thought, to crack. He knew the design team of mathematicians who'd figured out the algorithms. The algebraic formulas used in the -7 were sufficiently over his head that he had to strain to see the bottom. But what one mathematician could make, another, in theory, could break. And the Russians had good ones. And from that fact came the nightmare. The communications that it was his job to protect were being read by the enemy. And that just wouldn't do. So he had to use this pad for super-critical communications, inconvenient or not. It wasn't as though he had much of a social life in Moscow. Ordinary Russian citizens viewed his dark skin as an indication of some relationship with some tree-climbing African monkey, which was so offensive to Russell that he never talked about it to anyone, just let it generate rage in his heart, the sort of deep soul anger that he'd felt for the Ku Klux Klan before the FBI had put those ignorant crackers out of business. Maybe they still hated him. But a steer could lust after a lot of things without being able to fuck them. And so it was with those bigoted idiots who'd forgotten that Ulysses Simpson Grant had defeated Bobby Lee after all. They could hate all they wanted, but the prospect of Leavenworth Federal Pen kept them in their dark little holes. The Russians are just as bad, Russell thought. Racist cocksuckers. But he had his books and his tape player for cool jazz, and the extra pay that came with this hardship post. And for now, he'd show Ivan a signal he couldn't crack, and Foley would get his rabbit out. He lifted his phone and dialed the proper numbers. Foley. Russell. Want to come down to my office for a minute? On the way, the station chief replied. 4 minutes. What is it, Mike? He asked, coming through the door. Russell held up the ring binder. Only 3 copies of this.
Us, Langley, and Fort Meade. You want secure, my man. You got secure. Just try to keep the messages short, okay? This shit can really jack up my blood pressure. Okay, Mike. Shame there isn't a better way of doing that. Maybe someday. Ought to be a way to do it with a computer. You know, put the pad on a floppy disk. Maybe I'll write to Fort Meade about it, Russell thought. This stuff can make you cross-eyed. Better you than me, Foley couldn't say. Okay, I'll have something for you later today. Right, Russell nodded. He didn't have to add that it would also be enciphered on his KH-7 and then super-encrypted with the pad. He hoped that Ivan would intercept the signal and give his cryptanalysts the document to work on. Thinking about those bastards going nuts over one of his signals was one of the things he liked to smile about. Fine. Give their world-class math aces this stuff to fool with. But there was no telling. If KGB had managed, for example, to plant a bug in the building, it would be powered not by an internal battery, but rather by microwave emanations from Our Lady of the Microchips across the street. He had two permanent staff people who roamed the embassy, searching for unexplained RF signals. Every so often they found one and dug the bug out. But the last of those had been 20 months before. Now they said that the embassy was fully swept and fully clean. But nobody believed that. Ivan was just too clever. Russell wondered how Foley kept his identity a secret. But that was not his problem. Keeping the comms secure was hard enough. Back in his office, Foley drafted his next signal to Langley, trying to keep it as short as possible to make it easy for Russell. It would surely open some eyes on the 7th floor. He hoped that the Brits hadn't gotten word on the idea to Washington yet. That would be seen as a major impropriety, and senior officials everywhere got their noses out of joint on trivial crap like that. But with some things you just didn't have time to run it through channels, and as a senior station chief, it was expected that he would show some initiative once in a while. And along with initiative, maybe a little panache. Foley checked his watch. He was wearing his reddest tie, and he was an hour and a half from taking the metro home, and the rabbit needed to see him and the flag signal. A little voice was telling Foley to get Beatrix moving as fast as practicable. Whether it was danger to the rabbit or something else, he couldn't tell. But Foley was one to trust his instincts. Chapter 21. Vacation. It wasn't easy, really, to make sure one took the right subway train. Both the rabbit and Foley were using the inhuman efficiency of what had to be the only aspect of Soviet life that actually functioned properly. And the remarkable thing was that the trains ran on a schedule that was as regular and predictable as the setting of the sun, just far more frequent. Foley got his dispatch into Mike Russell's hands, then put his raincoat on and walked out the embassy front door at exactly the right moment, walked at exactly the usual pace, and got to the subway platform at exactly the right time, then turned to verify it with the clock that hung on the ceiling of the station. Yeah, he'd done it again. The train pulled in just as the previous train pulled out, and Foley walked aboard the usual car, turning to see. Yes, the rabbit was there. Foley unfolded his paper. His unbuttoned raincoat hung loosely on his shoulders. Zaitsev was actually surprised to see the red tie, but he could hardly complain. As usual, he inched his way in the proper direction. It was almost routine now, the COS thought. He felt the hand surreptitiously enter his pocket and withdraw. Then his acute senses felt the man take a step away. Hopefully there would be little more of this.
It was safe for Foley, but decidedly unsafe for the rabbit, however skillful he might have become at this exercise. The presence of others on this subway car, some faces he recognized from repetition, could well represent people of the Second Chief Directorate. There could be intermittent surveillance on him, using a bunch of different officers. That would be a sensible tactic for the opposition to use on and off, to diminish the chance that he'd spot them. In due course, as before, the train arrived at the appointed stop, and Foley walked off. In a few more weeks, he'd have to put the lining in his coat and maybe even wear the shepka Mary Pat had bought him. He had to start thinking about what would happen after they got the rabbit out. If Beatrix worked all the way, he'd have to maintain his cover activities for a time, or maybe switch to driving to the embassy, a change in routine that the Russians would not note as unusual. He was an American, after all, and Americans were famous for driving everywhere. The metro was getting tedious. Too crowded, often with people who didn't know what a shower was for. The things he did for his country, Foley thought. No, he corrected himself, the things he did against his country's enemies. That was what made it worthwhile. Given the big old bear a bellyache. Maybe even stomach cancer, he mused, walking to his apartment. Yes, Alan, Charleston asked, looking up from his desk. This is a major operation, I take it, Kingshot asked. Major in its objective, yes, the Director General confirmed. As routine as possible in its operation. We only have 3 people in Budapest, and it would not be overly brilliant to fly in a goon squad. Anyone else going? Jack Ryan, the American, Sir Basil said. He's no field officer, Kingshot objected immediately. It's fundamentally an American operation, Alan. They reasonably requested that one of their people go along to observe. In return, we'll have a day or two to debrief their rabbit at a safe house of our choosing. He will doubtless have a good deal of useful information, and we'll get the first chance to speak with him. Well, I hope this Ryan fellow doesn't queer the pitch for us. Alan, he's shown himself to be fairly level-headed in time of trouble, hasn't he? Sir Basil asked, reasonable as ever. Must be his marine training, Kingshot observed with dark generosity. And he's very clever, Alan. He's been giving us excellent work on his analysis project. If you say so, sir. To get the 3 bodies, I need to get some help from Special Branch, and then spend time on my knees hoping for something dreadful to happen. What are you thinking? Kingshot explained his nascent operational concept. It was really the only way to make something like this happen. And as Sir Basil had observed earlier in the day, it was as grisly as an autopsy. How likely is such a thing to happen? Basil asked. I need to talk with the police to answer that one. Who's your contact there? Chief Superintendent Patrick Nolan. You've met him. Charleston closed his eyes for a moment. The huge chap. Arrests Rugby forwards for light exercise. That's Nolan. They call him Tiny on the force. I think he eats barbells with his porridge. Am I free to discuss this Operation Beatrix with him? Just in terms of our needs, Alan. Very good, sir, Kingshot agreed and left the room. You won't? Nolan asked over a pint in a pub a block from New Scotland Yard, just after 4 in the afternoon. You heard me, Tiny, Kingshot said. He lit a cigarette to fit in with the rest of the bar's patrons. Well, I must say, I've heard a lot of strange things in my time with the Yard, but never that. Nolan was a good 6'4 and 230 pounds, very little of it fat. He spent at least an hour 3 times a week in the Yard's exercise room. He rarely carried a handgun on duty. He'd never needed one to help a felon see the futility of resistance. "Can you say what this is for?" he asked. "Sorry, not allowed to. All I can say is that it's a matter of some importance." A long pull on his beer. "Well, you know that we do not keep such things in cold storage, even in the Black Museum." I was thinking a traffic smash. They happen all the time, don't they?
Yes, they do, Alan, but not to a family of three.
Well, how often do such things happen? Kingshot asked.
Perhaps 20 such incidents in an average year, and their occurrence is wholly irregular. You cannot depend on it in any given week.
Well, we'll just have to hope for good luck, and if it doesn't happen, then it simply does not happen.
That would be an inconvenience. Perhaps it would be better to enlist the help of the Americans. They killed at least 50,000 people per year on their highways.
He'd suggest that to Sir Basil in the morning, Kingshot decided.
Good luck?
Not sure I'd call it that, Alan, Nolan pointed out.
You know what I mean, Tiny. All I can say is that it's bloody important.
And if it happens out on the M4, then what?
We collect the bodies.
And the survivors of the deceased? Nolan asked.
We substitute weighted bags for their bodies. The condition of the corpses will preclude an open casket ceremony, won't it?
Yes, there is that.
Then what?
We'll have our people deal with the bodies.
You really do not need to know the details.
The SIS had a close and cordial relationship with the Metropolitan Police, but it went only so far.
Nolan finished his pint.
Yes, I'll leave the nightmares to you, Alan.
He managed not to shiver.
I should start keeping my eyes open at once, is it?
Immediately.
And we should consider taking the leavings from more than one such incident?
Obviously. Kingshot nodded.
Another round?
Good idea, Alan, Nolan agreed. And his host waved to the barman.
You know, someday I'd love to know what you are using me for.
Someday after we are both retired, Patrick, you'll be pleased to know what you were helping with. That I can promise you, old man.
If you say so, Alan.
Nolan conceded the point. For now.
What the hell? Judge Moore observed, reading the last dispatch from Moscow. He handed the fresh copy over to Greer, who scanned it and passed it along to Mike Bostock.
Mike, your boy Foley has a lively imagination, the Admiral commented.
This sounds more like Mary Pat. She's the cowboy.
Well, cowgirl, I suppose you'd say.
It is original, guys.
Original isn't the word, the DCI said, rolling his eyes somewhat.
Okay, Mike, is it doable?
Theoretically, yes. And I like the operational concept. To get a defector and keep Ivan ignorant of the fact.
That's style, gentlemen, Bostock said admiringly.
The ugly part is that you need three bodies, one of them a child.
The three intelligence executives managed not to shudder at the thought. It was easiest, oddly, for Judge Moore, who'd managed to get his hands wet 30 years earlier. But that had been in time of war, when the rules were a lot looser. But not loose enough for him to keep from having regrets. That was what had gotten him back into the law. He couldn't take back the things he'd done wrong, but he could make sure they wouldn't happen again.
Or something like that, he told himself now. Something like that.
Why a car crash? Moore asked. Why not a house fire? Doesn't that suit the tactical purposes better?
Good point, Bostock agreed at once. Less physical trauma to have to explain away.
I'll shoot that off to Basil.
Even the most brilliant of people, Moore realized, could be limited in their thinking.
Well, that was why he kept telling people to think outside the box.
And every so often, someone managed to do that. Just not often enough.
You know, Mike Bostock said after a little thinking, this will be something if we can pull it off.
If can be a very large word, Mike, Greer cautioned.
Well, maybe this time the glass is half full, the deputy DDO suggested.
Fine. The main mission is getting this guy out, but the goose can use a little sauce once in a while.
Greer observed dubiously.
Well, I'll call Emil over at the Bureau and see what he has to say about this, Moore said.
more his turf than ours.
And if some lawyer gets hold of it, then what, Arthur?
James, there are ways of dealing with lawyers.
A pistol is often useful, Greer didn't say. He nodded concurrence. One bridge to cross at a time was always a good rule, especially in this crazy business.
How did things go today, honey? Mary Pat asked.
Ah, the usual, was the reply for the microphones in the ceiling. More significant was the double thumbs up, followed by the pass of the note from his coat pocket. They had a meeting place and a time. MP would handle that. She read the note and nodded. She and Eddie would take another walk to meet little Svetlana, the Zaitchik. Then it was just a matter of getting the rabbit out of town, and since he was KGB, it ought not to be overly hard. That was one advantage of having him work at the center. They were taking out a minor nobleman, after all, not just another mujik from the widget factory. Dinner, he saw, was steak, the usual celebratory meal. MP was as psyched about this as he was, probably more so. With just a little luck, this Operation Beatrix would make their reputation, and a good field rep was something they both wanted. Ryan took the usual train back to Chatham. He'd missed his wife again, but she'd had a routine day, so she'd probably left early, like all the government-employed docs with whom she worked. He wondered if this bad habit would carry over when they went home to Peregrine Cliff. Probably not. Bernie Katz liked to have his desk clean and waiting lists at zero, and the local work habits were driving his wife to drink. The good news was that with no surgery scheduled this week, they'd be able to have wine that evening with dinner. He wondered how long he'd be away from home. It wasn't something he was used to. One advantage of being an analyst was that he did all of his work at the office, then drove home. He'd rarely slept away from his wife in all the time they'd been married, a rule almost sacred in their marriage. He liked it when he woke up at 3 a.m. and could roll over and kiss her in mid-dream, then see her smile in her sleep. His marriage to Kathy was the anchor to his life, the very center of his universe. But now duty would take him away from her for several days. Not something he looked forward to. Nor did he look forward to flying on another goddamn airplane into a communist country with false identity papers and overseeing a black operation there. He didn't know shit about them, just what he'd picked up talking to the occasional field spook at Langley. And from his own experiences here in London, and at home over the Chesapeake, when Sean Miller and his terrorists had come to his house with guns blazing. It was something he tried very hard to forget. It might have been different had he stayed in the Marine Corps, but there he would have been surrounded by fellow warriors. He'd have been able to bathe in their respect, to remember his feat of arms with pride at having done the right thing at the right time, to recount his deeds to the interested, to pass along the tactical lessons learned the hard way on the field of demi-battle over beers at the O Club, even to smile about something that one didn't ordinarily smile about. But he'd left the Marine Corps with a bad back, and had had to endure his combat as a very frightened civilian. Courage, though, he'd once been told, was being the only one who knew how terrified you were. And yeah, he supposed he'd shown that quality when it had counted. And his job in Hungary would be only to watch, and then, the important part, to sit in while Sir Basil's boys interviewed the rabbit at some safe house in London, or wherever, before the Air Force probably flew them to Washington in their own special mission KC-135, out of RAF Bentwaters, with nice food and plenty of liquor to ease the flight fright. He walked off the train and up the steps and caught a cab for Grisdale Close, where he found that Kathy had sent Miss Margaret away and was busy in the kitchen, assisted, he saw, by Sally. "Hey, babe." Kiss. He lifted Sally for the usual hug. Little girls give the best hugs. "So, what was the important message about?" Kathy asked. "No big deal. kind of disappointing, actually. Kathy turned to look her husband in the eye. Jack couldn't lie worth a damn. It was one of the things she liked about him, actually.
Honest, babe, Ryan said, knowing the look, and then deepening the hole in which he was standing. I didn't get shot at or anything.
Okay, she acknowledged, meaning, we'll talk about it later.
Blew it again, Jack, Ryan told himself.
How's the glasses business? Saw 6 people, had time for 8 or 9, but that's all I had on my list. Have you told Bernie about working conditions here? Called him today, right after I got home. He had himself a good laugh and told me to enjoy the vacation.
What about the guys who had a brewski during a procedure?
Kathy turned. He said, and I quote, Jack's in the CIA, isn't he? Have him shoot the bastards. End of quote. She turned back to her cooking.
You need to tell him that we don't do that sort of thing.
Jack managed to smile. This, at least, wasn't a lie, and he hoped she could tell.
I know. You'd never be able to carry it on your conscience.
Too Catholic, he confirmed.
Well, at least I know you'll never fool around on me.
May God strike me dead with cancer if I ever do. It was the one imprecation about cancer that she almost approved of.
You'll never have reason to, Jack.
And that was true enough. She didn't like guns and she didn't like bloodshed, but she did love him. And that was sufficient to the moment. Dinner turned out okay, followed by the usual evening activities, until it was time for their 4-year-old to put on her yellow sleeper and climb into her big girl bed. With Sally in bed and little Jack dozing as well, there was time for the usual mindless TV watching. Or so Jack hoped, until...
Okay, Jack, what's the bad news?
Nothing much, he answered. The worst possible answer. Kathy was just too good at reading his mind.
What's that mean?
I have to go on a little trip. To Bonn, Jack remembered the advice from Sir Basil. It's a NATO thing I got stuck with.
Doing what?
I can't say, babe.
How long?
3 or 4 days, probably. They think I am uniquely suited to this for some damn reason or another. Ryan's semi-truthfulness was just oblique enough to foil her mind-reading for once.
You're not going to be carrying a gun or anything.
Honey, I am an analyst, not a field officer, remember? That sort of thing is not my job. For that matter, I don't think field spooks carry guns very much anyway. Too hard to explain away if somebody notices.
But James Bond is in the movies, babe, not real life.
Ryan returned his attention to the TV. ITV was doing a repeat of Danger, UXB, and again Jack found himself wondering if Brian would survive his job of defusing unexploded bombs, and then marry Susie when he returned to civilian life.
EOD. Now there was a miserable job, but if you made a mistake, at least it wouldn't hurt for very long.
Heard anything from Bob? Greer asked just before 6 in the evening. Judge Moore stood up from his expensive swivel chair and stretched. Too much time sitting down and not enough moving around. Back in Texas, he had a small ranch. Called that because he owned 3 quarter horses. You couldn't be a prominent citizen in Texas unless you owned a horse or two. And 3 or 4 times a week, he'd saddle Aztec up and ride around for an hour or so, mainly to get his head clear, to allow himself to think outside his office. That was how he tended to get his best thinking done. Maybe, Moore thought, that's why he felt so goddamned unproductive here. An office just wasn't a very good place for thinking, but every executive in the world pretended it was. Christ knew why. That's what he needed at Langley, his own stable. There was plenty of room on the Langley campus.
A good 5 times what he had in Texas. But if he ever did that, the stories would spread around the world. The American DCI liked to ride horses with his black Stetson hat that went along with a horse, and probably a Colt 45 on his hip. That was optional, and that just wouldn't look good to the TV crews that would sooner or later appear at the perimeter fence with their minicams. And so, for reasons of personal vanity, he had to deny himself the chance to do some good creative thinking. It was totally asinine, the former judge told himself, to allow such considerations to affect the way he did his work. Over in England, Basil could chase foxes on the back of a nice Hunter thoroughbred, and would anyone over there care? Hell no. He'd be admired for it, or at worst, thought a tiny bit eccentric, in a country where eccentricity was an admirable quality. But in the land of the free, men were enslaved by customs imposed on them by news reporters and elected officials who screwed their secretaries. Well, there was no rule that the world had to make sense, was there? Nothing important. Just a cable that said his meetings with our Korean friends were going well, Moore reported. You know, those people scare me a little, Greer observed. He didn't have to explain why. The KCIA occasionally had its field personnel deal a little too directly with employees of the other Korean government. The rules were a little different over there. The ongoing state of war between North and South was still a very real thing, and in time of war, some people lost their lives. CIA hadn't done such things in almost 30 years. Asian people hadn't adopted Western ideas of the value of human life. Maybe because their countries were just too crowded. Maybe because they have different religious beliefs. Maybe a lot of things, but for whatever reason, they were just a little different in the operational parameters they felt free to work within. Or without. They're our best eye on North Korea and China, James, Moore reminded him. And they are very faithful allies. I know, Arthur. It was nice to hear things about the People's Republic of China once in a while. Penetrating that country was one of CIA's most frustrating tasks. I just wish they weren't so cavalier about murder. They operate within fairly strict rules, and both sides seem to play by them. And on both sides, killings had to be authorized at a very high level. Not that this would matter all that much to the corpse in question. Wet operations interfered with the main mission, which was gathering information. That was something people occasionally forgot, but something that CIA and KGB mainly understood, which was why both agencies had gotten away from it. But when the information retrieved frightened or otherwise upset the politicians who oversaw the intelligence services, then the spook shops were ordered to do things that they usually preferred to avoid. And so then they took their action through surrogates and or mercenaries, mainly. Arthur, if KGB wants to hurt the Pope, how do you suppose they'd go about it? Not one of their own, Moore thought. Too dangerous. It would be a political catastrophe, like a tornado going right through the Kremlin. It would sure as hell kibosh Yuri Vladimirovich's political career, and, you know, I don't see him taking that much risk for any cause. Power is just too important to him. The DDI nodded. Agreed. I think he's going to resign his chairmanship soon. Has to. They wouldn't even let him jump from KGB boss to the general secretaryship. That's a little too sinister even for them. They still remember Beria. The ones who sit around that table do, anyway. That's a good point, James, Moore said, turning back from the window. I wonder how much longer Leonid Ilyich has. Ascertaining Brezhnev's health was a constant CIA interest. Hell, it was a matter of interest to everyone in Washington. Andropov is our best indicator on that. We're pretty sure he's Brezhnev's replacement. When it looks like Leonid Ilyich is heading for the last roundup, then Yuri Vladimirovich changes jobs.
Good point, James. I'll float that to State in the White House.
Admiral Greer nodded.
It's what they pay us for.
Back to the Pope, he suggested.
The President is still asking questions, Moore confirmed.
If they do anything, it won't be a Russian. Too many political pitfalls, Arthur.
Again, I agree. But what the hell does that leave us?
They use the Bulgarians for wet work, Greer pointed out.
So, look for a Bulgarian shooter.
How many Bulgars make pilgrimages to Rome, you suppose?
We can't tell the Italians to look into that, can we? It would leak sure as hell, and we can't have that. It would look pretty stupid in the press.
It's just something we can't do, James.
Greer let out a long breath.
Yeah, I know. Not without something firm.
Firmer than what we have now. And that's air, James, just plain damned air.
It would be nice, Judge Moore thought, if CIA were as powerful as the movies and the critics think we are.
Not all the time, just once in a while.
But they weren't, and that was a fact. The next day started in Moscow before it started anywhere else. Zaitsev awoke at the ringing of his wind-up alarm clock, grumbled and cursed like every working man in the world, then stumbled off to the bathroom. 10 minutes later, he was drinking his morning tea and eating his black bread and butter. Less than a mile away, the Foley family was doing much the same thing. Ed decided on an English muffin and grape jelly with his coffee for a change, joined by little Eddie, who took a break from Worker Woman and his Transformers tapes. He was looking forward to the preschool that had been set up for Western children right there in the ghetto, where he showed great promise with crayons and the newly arrived Hot Wheels tricycles, plus being champion at the sit and spin. He told himself that he could relax today. The meeting would be in the evening, and MP would handle that. In another week or so, maybe, Beatrix would be all over, and he could relax again, letting his field officers do the running around this damned ugly city. Sure enough, the goddamn Baltimore Orioles were in the playoffs and looking to go head-to-head with the Philadelphia Phillies, relegating his Bronx Bombers to the Hot Stove League yet again. What was with the new ownership anyway? How could rich people be so stupid? He'd have to keep to his metro routine. If KGB had him shadowed, it would be unusual. Or would it, for them to mark the specific train he was getting on? There was a question for him. If they did a 1-2 tail, the number two guy would stay on the platform and, after the train left, write down the time off the clock in the station. That was the only one that made sense, since it was the one that governed the trains themselves. KGB was thorough and professional, but would they be that good? That sort of precision was positively Germanic, but if the bastards could make the trains run that precisely, then probably KGB could take note of it, and the precise timing was what had enabled him to contact the rabbit. God damn this life anyway, Foley raged briefly. But he'd known that before he'd accepted the posting to Moscow, and it was exciting here, wasn't it?
Yeah. Like Louis XVI was probably excited on the cart ride to the guillotine, Ed Sr. thought. Someday he'd lecture on this down at the farm. He hoped they'd appreciate just how hard it had been to write the lesson plan for his Operation Beatrix lecture. Well, they might be a little impressed. 40 minutes later, he purchased his copy of Izvestia and rode down the interminable escalator to the platform, as usual, not noting the sideways looks of Russians looking at a real live American, as though he were a creature in the zoo. It would never have happened to a Russian in New York, where every ethnic group could be found, especially behind the wheel of a yellow cab. The morning routine was set in concrete by now. Miss Margaret was hovering over the kids, and Eddie Beaverton was outside the door. The kids were duly hugged and kissed, and the parents headed off to work. If there was anything Ryan hated, it was this routine. If only he'd been able to persuade Kathy to buy a flat in London, then every workday would have been a good 2 hours shorter. But no, Kathy wanted green stuff around for the kids to play on. And soon they wouldn't see the sun until they got to work, and soon thereafter, hardly even then. 10 minutes later, they were in their first-class compartment, rolling northwest for London, Kathy in her medical journal and Jack in his Daily Telegraph. There was an article about Poland, and this reporter was unusually well-informed, Ryan saw at once. The articles in Britain tended to be a lot less long-winded than in the Washington Post, and for once Jack found himself regretting that. This guy had been well-briefed, and or he was pretty good at analysis. The Polish government was really caught between a rock and a hard place, and was getting squeezed. And there was talk, he saw, that the Pope was making some rumbles about the welfare of his homeland and his people. And that, the reporter noted, could upset a lot of apple carts. Ain't that the truth, Jack thought. The really bad news was that it was in the open now. Who'd leaked it? He knew the reporter's name. He was a specialist in foreign affairs, mainly European. So, who'd leaked this? Somebody in the Foreign Office? Those people were, on the whole, pretty smart, but like their American counterparts at Foggy Bottom, they occasionally spoke without thinking. And over here, that could happen over a friendly pint in one of the thousands of comfortable pubs. Maybe in a quiet corner booth, with a government employee paying off a marker, or just wanting to show the media how smart he was. Would a head roll over this one, he wondered. Something to talk about with Simon. Unless Simon had been the leaker. He was senior enough and well-liked by his boss. Maybe Basil had authorized the leak. Or maybe they both knew a guy in Whitehall and had authorized him to have a friendly pint with a guy from Fleet Street. Or maybe the reporter was smart enough to put two and two together all by himself. Not all the smart guys worked at Century House. Damn sure not all the smart ones in America worked at Langley. Generally speaking, talent went to where the money was, because smart people wanted large houses and nice vacations just like everyone else did. Those who went into government service knew that they could live comfortably, but not lavishly. But the best of them also knew that they had a mission to fulfill in life, and that was why you found very good people wearing uniforms or carrying guns and badges. In his own case, Ryan had done well in the trading business, but he finally found it unsatisfying. And so, not all talented people sought after money. Some found themselves on some sort of quest. "Is that what you're doing, Jack?" he asked himself as the train pulled into Victoria Station. "What deep thoughts this morning?" his wife asked. "Huh?" Jack responded. "I know the look, honey," she pointed out. "You're chewing over something important. Kathy, are you an eye-cutter or a shrink?" "With you, I'm a shrink," she replied with a playful smile. Jack stood and opened the compartment door. "Okay, my lady. You have eyeballs to regulate, and I have secrets to figure out." He waved his wife out the door. "What new things did you learn from the Asshole and Armpit Monthly Gazette on the way in?" "You wouldn't understand." "Probably," Jack conceded, heading off to the cab stand. They took a robin's egg blue one instead of the usual black. "Hammersmith Hospital," Ryan told the driver, "and then 100 Westminster Bridge Road." "MI6, is it, sir?" "Excuse me?" Ryan replied innocently. "Universal Export, sir, where James Bond used to work." He chuckled and pulled off. Well, Ryan reflected, the CIA exit off the George Washington Parkway wasn't marked National Highway Administration anymore. Kathy thought it was pretty funny. There was no keeping secrets from London cab drivers. Kathy hopped out in a large underpass at Hammersmith, and the driver U-turned and went the last few blocks to Century House. Ryan went through the door, past Sergeant Major Canderton, and up to his office. Coming in the door, he dropped the telegraph on Simon's desk before doffing his raincoat.
I saw it, Jack, Harding said at once. Who's talking?
Not sure.
Foreign Office, probably.
They've been briefed in on this.
Or perhaps someone from the PM's office.
Sir Basil is not pleased, Harding assured him.
Nobody called the paper?
No. We didn't know about this until it was published this morning.
I thought the local papers had a more cordial relationship with the government over here.
Generally they do, which leads me to believe it was the PM's office that did the leak.
Harding's face was innocent enough, but Jack found himself trying to read it. That was something his wife was far better at. He had the feeling that Harding was not being entirely truthful, but he had no real reason to complain about that, did he?
Anything new from the overnights?
Harding shook his head.
Nothing of great interest. Nothing on this Beatrix operation either.
Tell your wife about your impending trip.
Yeah, and I didn't tell you that she's pretty good at reading my mind.
Most wives can, Jack. Harding had a good laugh at that.
Zaitsev had the same desk and the same pile of message traffic. Always different in exact details, but always the same, really. Reports from field officers transmitting data from foreign nationals on all manner of subjects. He had hundreds of operation names memorized and untold thousands of details resident between his ears, including the actual names of some of the agents and the code names of many, many others. As on the previous workdays, he took his time, reading over all the morning traffic before sending it upstairs, trusting his trained memory to record and file away all of the important details. Some, of course, contained information that was hidden in multiple ways.